Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Mushing Radio, and you're listening on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley, radiofreepalmer.org. You can find us over there on our live streaming site, as well as over on iTunes and Twitter and Facebook as well. Just search for Dog Works Radio. We are continuing our Mushing History series today, and on the line calling in from Southern California is our co-host. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. I'm very happy to be back here, and wanted to just say a brief thank you to everyone who contacted me after our last show and wished me a good recovery. I had a very bad sore throat, and my voice was a lot lower than it is now. So I'm happy to be on the mend and happy to be back with you talking about the second third of the Iditarod Trail.
Yeah, this is a fun series, Alex. I'm really enjoying doing this with you in the off season. I think we're covering some pretty good topics. And as you mentioned, the first third of the race was our last show. We talked about going from Anchorage up through Willow and on over to Takotna, where a lot of the mushers take their mandatory 24-hour break. And now we're going to break it up into the second third of the race, and we're going to go through about another 300 or so miles, starting with the trail from Takotna to Ophir. What do you have, Alex?
Right. So from Takotna to Ophir is only 23 miles, but it has a lot of ups and downs. There's a 9-mile climb from the Kuskokwim River up to the Anako River. And I apologize if I butcher any of these names. And if you know the correct pronunciation and I get them wrong, please correct me. Goes up about 800 feet, steady, gentle switchbacks, and then it goes down for 8 miles, a nice long downhill along Independence Creek, and then the last 15 miles into Ophir. The checkpoint at Ophir. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
The checkpoint at Ophir is usually at Dick and Audra Forsgren's cabin, which was built in the 1930s. There's not much left in Ophir right now. It used to be, it's one of these villages that used to have a much bigger population and has really kind of dwindled. It's now pretty much an airport and a couple of buildings. And Dick and Audra fly out every year to run the checkpoint. And it's considered a classic Iditarod checkpoint because it's a little cabin. And they put a lantern in the window at night. So when you're coming in at night, you can see this glowing lantern, and there's not really much around. This is considered the beginning of sort of the big middle of Iditarod, where you're in a lot of areas where there's just not very much there. There aren't a lot of people who live in these villages year-round, and it is Ophir is considered the last of civilization because there's actually a year-round presence in Ophir. Once you get past Ophir, you are really in the middle of nowhere. You're in places that are either abandoned during the winter, or some of them have summer presences, but not many people who live there during the winter. So this is really the last place for a while where you will be around a lot of people.
You know, that's what I was going to say too, Alex. It begins to start those long stretches of being out there on your own. And you'll often find, especially if you're watching the tracker, this is when a lot of the middle to back of the packers begin to start traveling together and forming those traveling parties or those camping parties together, because it's so far and so long and you're really out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also where you start to get the more experienced mushers who know how to handle some of these longer stretches and know how to break up the stretches. And know there are a couple of a couple of runs that we'll get to later in the show where it is very, very repetitious, and that can be difficult both for the dogs, especially dogs who aren't really experienced on the trail, and also for the mushers, because you think that you've been going for a certain amount of time, so you feel like you should be at the next landmark, but some of these sections of the trail don't have a lot of landmarks, and it's a lot of back and forths on rivers, and it's a lot of scenery that looks very, very much the same. So you can be traveling for 3 hours and think, I should have been there a half hour ago, when in fact you've got another 2 hours to go. It just all looks the same.
And as you mentioned, it's a relatively short run from Takatna over to Ophir, so there's not a lot of strategy that goes into it, so to speak, about, okay, I need to take this much gear to go this far, because it's a relatively short run, and you often don't see a lot of teams scratching on these next couple of checkpoints. Do you know why that is, Alex?
I think it's because it is it's a section of the trail that is relatively short, and it's also it's not a section where the weather is really horrible and threatening.
Right.
Where as we come up to some of the later checkpoints, you get a lot of stretches where there's no real cover, where if a sudden whiteout or a sudden storm comes up, you can just be out in the middle of nowhere and not have anything to protect you. Also, when we start getting onto the Yukon, there are a lot of stretches where it can be bitterly, bitterly cold, and you're often running right into the wind, and sometimes the wind in some of the areas on the Yukon, the wind chill can get to be up to 100 degrees below zero, which, you know, is just so cold that I'm not sure there's any real way to think about that.
Right. So then we head over to the namesake of the race itself, at least on the southern route, which is ran on the odd numbered years, which what we are in now, if we wouldn't have ran from Fairbanks on over. So now we're heading to Iditarod. What's that all about?
Right. So this is one of the longest stretches on the Iditarod race from Ophir to Iditarod. It's about 90 miles. I should just mention briefly that the mileage on all of these legs is approximate rather than exact, because the depending on the exact conditions along the trail will sometimes take slightly different paths, in a very localized way. So sometimes you will go to the left to go away from a river that has overflow, or sometimes you'll go, you know, more straight when it's colder. So these mileages are all approximate. It goes to the same checkpoints, but the exact route differs. This leg is considered one of the emptiest portions of the trail. There is just not very much there. There are a couple of cabins that fans of the race are probably familiar with. Between these two checkpoints, there's Don's Cabin, which is 36 miles from Ophir. It's basically a ramshackle hut, but it's well sheltered in trees, and it has a stove. There's also a popular camping spot at Windy Creek Crossing, which is about halfway between Ophir and Iditarod. Once you leave Ophir, you're climbing up through Black Spruce for about 10 miles, and you briefly go above the tree line, and then you go across this flat area called Beaver Flats, where there's a small range of mountains on the side. Once you get to the halfway point, you slowly climb back up and then drop down to First Chance Creek, and then follow a valley to the Iditarod River, past creeks and swamps and lakes. The town of Iditarod is, calling it a town is perhaps an exaggeration, it's an abandoned town The checkpoint is right across from the few remaining buildings that are still there. Most things in Iditarod have been reclaimed by nature, and the checkpoint is usually set up in an old house that used to be used by a trapper. The nearest town to Iditarod is, the nearest town that has a population is Flat, which is 8 miles away and has a year-round population in the single digits. The actual town of Iditarod once had 10,000 people. In 1910, I believe it had over 10,000 people, and they had electricity and telephones, newspapers, banks, hotels. Almost everything has been reclaimed by nature, and it's considered one of the most desolate and lonely places on the trail.
If we could back up just a second, Alex, to Ophir.
Yeah.
That is also the point where the route changes from year to year, going north or south. Do you know why that they do that? Is there some history behind that, or is it just paying respect to the different villages each and every other year?
Yeah, it's the first few years they only did the northern route, and they added the southern route in 1977. And the primary reason is that in that middle part of the race, you're going through villages that have a very, very small population. And to have the Iditarod come through the village is a considerable drain on their resources. And the villages love having the Iditarod come through, but it was considered that it would be easier and better for these villages to have the race come through every other year rather than every year.
In the northern route, those checkpoints there, in this second third of the race, are they more populated up there, do you know?
Yes, they are a little bit more populated. It is still very sparsely populated. When you talk about Unalakleet, which has a population of about 700 or 800, is considered a big city when you're in this part of the race. So we're talking about villages that have a year-round population of a couple dozen, maybe up to about 100.
Wow. That's hard to wrap your head around, living in a little place like that. We live in a little community of about 2,000 people, and that is really small compared to my standards. I can only imagine living out there where there's only a couple of dozen people. That's something that hard to comprehend, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, and people who live in Alaska and people who move to Alaska start to have a different idea of what constitutes overpopulation and what constitutes a large city. Anchorage, which I believe at this point has a population maybe of 350 or 400,000 people, is considered gigantic, and people want to move away from Anchorage and move to places like Wasilla or Willow. And then you get people who live a few years in a place like Willow with a population of a couple of thousand and say, that's just too much for me. I want to move to a place that has a population of maybe a couple of hundred. And as you can imagine, when you get to something like that, you have to be much more able to be self-reliant. You have to be able to, cope with emergencies. You have to be able to cope with having the power go out on a regular basis, or maybe not having running water, or access to the internet. And so a lot of the things that people like me who have been used to living, in cities, just take for granted, you cannot take for granted at all. You have to plan your trips to the store. You have to plan, what you're going to need. You can't just run out and buy soap if you run out of soap.
Right. So our next checkpoint, and this is the name that I always butcher, so I'm going to let you go ahead and say this one. We're at about 487 miles. What is the name of this checkpoint?
So I believe the name of this checkpoint is pronounced Shagaluk.
Okay.
But I could be wrong about that. And that's 55 miles from Iditarod. So we're looking at 145 miles where there's just not a lot. Between
right.
Iditarod and Shagaluk, there is basically nothing. It's hills. There's no cabins, no buildings. There was a forest fire there years ago, and the area hasn't yet completely grown back. I was looking at Don Bowers, who wrote the great book, Back of the Pack, also did fairly substantial trail notes for the Iditarod Trail. And I was looking at his trail notes, and he said that some people say that there are 9 big hills between Iditarod and Shagaluk, and some say there are 13. So this is one of those areas where you think you've been going for a while and you think you should have reached where you're going, but maybe there's still a lot more to go. The climbs in this leg of the race are generally between 500 and 1,000 feet of vertical gain and losses. You cross the Little Yetna and Big Yetna rivers. There starts to be more and more trees and timber as you go further west. The checkpoint is in a community center near the school in the village. And although it's not technically on the Yukon River, it is considered on the Yukon for the purpose of your 8-hour layover. And every team must take an 8-hour layover somewhere on the Yukon, and Shagaluk is considered on the Yukon for that purpose.
And for folks that do not know, you are required to take a 24-hour break somewhere along the trail, just about anywhere. As we mentioned last episode, most folks take it about Takotna or McGrath, somewhere in there, Roan, someplace in that area when we're traveling on this route. And then as Alex mentioned, this is where the strategy really begins to start to develop on these 8-hour breaks, because even when we're following on the trackers, we still haven't quite figured out who's in the lead at this point, unless they're really just blazing the trail. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And every year, or seemingly every year, you will have one or two teams who are what sometimes are referred to as jackrabbits. So they will go very, very far up the trail without taking their 24. And sometimes will be, over 100 miles or 150 miles ahead of the next team, which seems like a lot until you realize that then they have to rest somewhere in place for 24 hours, during which time the teams that have already taken their 24s will make up that distance. And a lot of times the teams that do sort of bound ahead run out of steam and then are very, very slow to finish the race and sometimes have trouble finishing the race. Whereas the teams that stuck to their plan and took their 24s a little bit earlier tend to be a lot better rested and able to start really building speed in the middle part of the course.
Right. So our next checkpoint is Anvik. We're at about 512 miles here. This is a little bit over halfway in terms of as the crow flies miles, as you mentioned. It changes a little bit year to year, but we're now 500 miles into the race here at Anvik and getting ready to hit onto the mighty Yukon. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So Anvik, I believe, positive about this, but I believe on the southern route is considered the halfway point, and there's a prize for the first team to get to the halfway point. Once you leave Shagaluk, you're on a very heavily used snow machine trail between the villages, which is very helpful. Sometimes the Iditarod Trail is in areas that are not really used during most winters, except for the running of the Iditarod. So this is considered a relatively easy section of the trail. It's you go across open swamps and lakes and through some wooded areas. There is a you climb up a very steep bank into town. The checkpoint is usually at the community center in town, and because it's only 18 miles from Anvik to the next checkpoint, Grayling, there are not a lot of teams that will stay in Anvik.
Right. So, as we mentioned, it's not a whole lot going on at Anvik. And again, this is one of those checkpoints where you don't see a whole lot of action happening. You don't see a lot of media here at a lot of these checkpoints. And you don't often see a lot of scratching because of just the logistics of getting in and out. If teams can push on to a little bit larger checkpoint with a little bit better amenities, it's a little bit easier to make those decisions. So let's head on down the race, Alex. We're going to head into Grayling, which is on the Yukon River. And as Don Bowers mentions in his trail notes, this can be where it's a real showstopper. And I know exactly what he means. I haven't been on the Yukon, but I do a lot of traveling with my teams, in particular on the Big Sioux River here in the valley. And your dogs will change dramatically when you hit these large rivers that are sometimes a mile across. And their attitude changes very quickly. They're no longer going through the twists and turns of through the tundra or through the woods. It's just a wide open highway. And oftentimes dogs will shut down on you very quickly on these long river runs.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially when there is any kind of wind, the dogs are very sensitive to the wind. And it's a different experience when you're running into the wind, but there are trees around because the trees help deflect it, and it feels like you have some protection. And I think the dogs instinctively sometimes know that it is an entirely different ballgame when you're on an open river and you are running into the wind. And
right.
This is the sort of area where some dogs who train a lot on open rivers have an advantage, and there's all sorts of strategy about getting lead dogs who can navigate this type of area. But as you mentioned, sometimes the dogs will just say, "No, I'm not going further in this."
Right, exactly. And if we could step back just to the prior checkpoint there, Alex, on the odd years on the southern route, you had mentioned that prize for the halfway point. Is that the prize with the meal, or is that a different one?
I believe it is a different one. I think the prize with the meal is the first to the Yukon River prize.
Okay, and we had mentioned that Anvik was considered on the Yukon, so I didn't know if that was considered that particular checkpoint. I know it's a lot more fanfare when it's on the northern route when they mention that, and you know they put the big spread on with the chef and all that. I just didn't know on the southern route if they do it at Anvik or they did it at Grayling.
I think they do it at Grayling, but I'm not positive about that.
So
I can double check that.
So our next checkpoint is all about the river. We are on the river now for many, many miles, and we're coming up to Eagle Island. Where are we at in terms of distance here at Eagle Island, Alex?
So Eagle Island is 592, so almost 600 miles into the race. As you mentioned, at this point, you are just on the open river, and it's going bend after bend of the Yukon. There are sometimes ridges that go up 1,500 feet within a few miles of the river. There are a few cabins and houses, but most of the buildings there are only used during the summer. There are a lot of fishing and hunting camps, and people sometimes will run. Don Bauer says it's very important to stay on the trail during this part of Iditarod because sometimes there is a lot of overflow on the river or there are weak sections of ice on the river. And he says every year people will run snow machines into the river inadvertently, and sometimes people will die from doing that. This is an area where, as we were talking about, the wind chills can get very, very intense. When it's cold and there's a good wind, you can get wind chills of 100 degrees below zero on this segment. So
right.
This is a segment of the trail that people think about when people who are not really exposed to Iditarod and don't know a lot about it think about what it must be like, because it is in the middle of nowhere. It's desolate. It's colder than you can imagine, and you really can feel like everything is always cold, and it's hard to imagine being warm again.
So we're going to come up to our last checkpoint here on the second episode of our race. I want to talk about Unalakleet in our next episode, because there's a lot of stories that happen there. But we're coming up to Kaltag. Before we go to Kaltag, back in the early days, they ran a lot of the big steamships or steamboats up and down the Yukon River, you know, the kind that a lot of people think about when they think about the Mississippi with the big paddles in the back. And
right.
in Fairbanks, they have a park. I believe it's called Pioneer Park, and they have a excellent scale model of all along the Yukon River and how it used to be back in the day with these steamships rolling back and forth. And if you ever get a chance to visit Fairbanks, definitely head over to Pioneer Park and check that out. It's a cool exhibit. Have you been there, Alex?
Yeah, I was there a long time ago, and it's just wonderful. And you really get a sense of how dependent upon the river a lot of these communities are.
Right. So Kaltag, let's talk a little bit about that one. We have about 4 minutes left, Alex, before we have to end for today. What do you know about this one?
So Kaltag is another 60 miles from Eagle Island. So between Kaltag and Grayling, you're talking about 125 miles more or less of just travel along the Yukon. It's very cold. It's often very windy, and there is not a lot to protect you there. So, generally speaking, people will want to break this up. You know, by stopping in Grayling. I believe a lot of people take their 8-hour Yukon layover in Grayling. The checkpoint is a log built community center in the middle of the town. There's a pump house there, and sometimes you can get hot water and shower. Once you get past Kaltag, the trails are much more well traveled, so it's always challenging, but it's not quite as challenging, especially in terms of the cold, once you get past Kaltag.
You know, I'm looking here at the trail notes from Don Bowers from Grayling to Kaltag, or Eagle Island to Kaltag, and it says on here the original Iditarod Trail never ran the Yukon. Went directly from Iditarod to Kaltag across the marshy maze of the Unico Valley. Old-time mushers on their way to Nome only saw the Yukon when they crossed it to Kaltag. I never knew that. That's an interesting little history tidbit there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would have to think that even though there are a lot of challenges with running on a big river like the Yukon, that they probably chose to do that because it was easier to maintain and perhaps a little bit faster to run on the river.
Very good. So, Alex, in our next episode coming up in a couple of weeks, we're going to go from Unalakleet on into Nome. That's probably going to be the most fascinating part of the trail. There's a heck of a lot of history and strategy that goes on in that last third. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. And The race is often considered to be several different races, and the way we've divided it up I think works really well, because you definitely have a very different strategy in the last third from Unalakleet going up to Nome.
Well, Alex, looking forward to it. We'll talk to you guys next time.